Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
It's Straight Outta Cobham, a show about Chelsea FC from The Athletic. On this episode, another draw against Brighton leaves more questions than answers. There's a look ahead to the final part of the Blues and Spurs January triple header. Chelsea have the best managers and the best goalkeeper, according to FIFA. We round up the rest of the Blues news and do a quiz. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic, this is Straight Outta Cobham. Tired, clunky and awkward. Listener, it could well be a description of my intros over the last few weeks. In this instance, though, I'm referring to the headline of one of our panellists' post-match piece. The piece in question was written for The Athletic after the Brighton game. The man who penned it is with us now. Morning, Dominic Fifield.
Good morning. How are you doing?
All right, thanks. Yeah. Bring in the positivity by pointing out Chelsea's favourable run-in. Simon Johnson's also with us. Hi, Simon.
Hello.
And I'm Matt, by the way. Hi. Later, we'll get the lowdown on Spurs from The Athletic's Charlie Eccleshare. But first on our agenda today is that midweek trip to the South Coast.
Webster's Brighton look to get in ahead of steam and they've got their goal. Adam Webster with a booming header and Brighton bite back.
They celebrated the draw in the end in the whistle as if they had won. That's the adversity we normally overcome, and you have to normally also overcome. But we are tired. It's a long spell now.
Brighton and Hove Albion 1, Chelsea 1. Then pretty wretched performance from the Blues, who missed the chance to go second and are now looking over their metaphorical shoulder rather than up at the teams above them. Dom, you were covering this game. We've had a couple of days to digest it now. Is it the crisis that the initial reaction on Chelsea Twitter made it out to be?
Crisis. Well, it's not great. One win in seven league games. I mean, as Tuchel was very quick to point out post-match, that there have been victories in cup competitions, not least the two semi-finals against Tottenham Hotspur within their recent sequence. So it's not all doom and gloom. But they do look very, very stretched and tired and knackered. And I think he's right in pointing that out. I mean, in his mind, it's a very simple scenario. Chelsea have played too many games in a short space of time, and they've had COVID and injuries to contend with as well. And they are knackered mentally and physically. And they looked it. I think I made the point in the piece, there are probably two teams in the Premier League that you don't want to play when you are feeling up against it in terms of fatigue, and Manchester City, one of them. They played them on Saturday. Brighton are probably the other. And I mean, Brighton were superb in both games against Chelsea. And I'm actually just glanced at the data from Tuesday's game, and it's very, very deceptive. It actually suggests that Chelsea had the majority of the ball and the majority of their chances. If you watched that game, you wouldn't have thought that at all. Because Brighton were the more composed team until really the last 10 minutes, when the three substitutions made a difference for Chelsea and instilled a bit of urgency and energy onto the pitch. And therein, actually, there is probably some criticism of Tuchel in terms of changes, in terms of some of the selections of late. He hasn't necessarily reacted quick enough maybe on during games or even with his original selections to freshen things up as much as he maybe might have done. You know, these things are, you can debate as much as you like, but the reality is the group that he picked and started with on Tuesday night at the Amex looked pretty off it from the start. They were very lucky to go ahead 1-0 at the break. It didn't feel like they were the dominant team at any point really until that last 5-10 minutes, and a point actually in the circumstances wasn't actually a bad result.
Simon, a lot of people were pointing to the bench, and Dom's mentioned the substitutions. They all came at once with 10 minutes to go. Undoubtedly, world-class players amongst those substitutes. But just looking through the names, you've got Kovacic, exhausted, having been injured. Pulisic, totally out of form. Werner, maybe never has been in form. Havertz, been injured, been ill. So it's not as if he had a whole load of options that he could have brought on at half-time or could have given starts to otherwise. And basically what I'm saying in a roundabout way is his argument about the fatigue is legitimate, isn't it, given the amount of games they've played in the time they played it in.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the sort of great contrasts between the two teams was the stat that since the 1st of December, Chelsea played 15 times, the Brighton's 9. That doesn't totally negate how poor Chelsea were in both games, but it does give an insight into why Brighton looked the fresher on both occasions. They benefited from two significant breaks during December, partly because obviously games were called off, of course, whereas Chelsea had to play basically every 3 or 4 days. But I just think that fatigue is a genuine factor, but it's not the be-all and end-all of what's going on here. It looks to me like they've stopped enjoying their football. You know, it feels like football's become a grind to them. And nothing was more alarming, of course, than Ziyech's goal celebration or lack of. I'm not quite sure why he himself is upset. One can obviously sort of think, well, it's because he doesn't feel he's being played enough, or he took exception to the criticism that Tuchel made post Man City about the attacking players weren't good enough. But he was right. I mean, how on earth Ziyech could remotely sort of defend his performance against Man City and think he was hard done by. Yeah, I have some sympathy for him in terms of him being always substituted. I thought it was a bit harsh on him against Brighton, because whilst he wasn't amazing, he was one of the better players, especially after he scored. Like, before that, he was horrific. Then he scored a goal out of nowhere, and it seemed to re-energise him, and he seemed to be a bit more involved, even if it was a heated debate with Lukaku over a certain pass, which, I thought betrayed the mood that's in the camp. I mean, I didn't think it was a bad flashpoint. I didn't think it was a particularly bad pass. Lukaku's obviously in a bit of a strop at the moment for a number of reasons. His reaction since that apology, you know, I'm going to make it up. You know, essentially, I'm going to make it up to you. Well, we're still waiting, Romelu, and perhaps stop throwing your arms up in the air every 5 minutes and get on with playing football. I have sympathies for him as well, because his teammates aren't.
Doesn't sound like it.
well, I think you got to sort of look at it in a balanced way, and that he should be criticised, but also there's an element of why aren't his teammates looking to pass to him more? I don't quite understand it. There were times in the second half where they passed the ball up to him, and he held it up and passed it to a teammate, and suddenly Chelsea were on the move, and he just went, this is what he's in the team for. But they don't seem to be looking for him enough.
But wasn't that Ziyech flashpoint? Because that was 3 minutes before the interval, wasn't it? And yeah. Ziyech gets the ball, and Lukaku wants a certain ball played to him to get the best out of him. And actually, yeah, what Ziyech does is he forces him wide with a pass. And isn't that what you just said in a nutshell? That yes, Lukaku should be probably doing a bit more, but actually his teammates aren't really giving him the ammunition to do that, because they're putting him in areas of the pitch he doesn't really want to be.
Yeah, I mean the why I sort of found that exchange pretty strange was that at least the pass had gone to him.
Yeah, well, true. Yeah.
it's like come on Romelu, at least you got a pass at last. No, but you could see why he was annoyed, because he obviously wanted it down the middle rather than towards the touchline, and what could he do with that? But I just thought it was that exchange, which actually carried on talk. They carried on talking, didn't they, just before the second half restarted? Again, just sort of give this impression that all is not well between everybody. And this is what happens when you have a string of bad results as well. You know, it's hard to maintain that happy-go-lucky, everyone loving life exterior when you're finding wins hard to come by.
Yeah, I guess there's another factor for Ziyech in that he's probably watching his Moroccan teammates playing in AFCON and thinking I ought to be there as well, and I'm not particularly enjoying what I'm doing here. Dom, you pointed out in your post-match piece that maybe a few days off, which Thomas Tuchel pointed out he will be giving them, or they are on one of them as we record today, and then a little trip to Abu Dhabi might be just what they need to kind of refresh things. That's a positive way of looking at it.
Well, the Abu Dhabi bit, yeah, I mean, it's maybe that's me being optimistic. I mean, they'll benefit more from having a complete week off, obviously, which will be their winter break. This is all very confusing, but it's the last weekend in January, effectively, they'll get off, and then they'll have the FA Cup the following week. So they don't get the two weekends off that some Premier League clubs will have. I mean, yeah, they will. I mean, the 2 days off, it'll be really interesting to see what effect 2 days completely devoid of football, whether that refreshes this group ahead of Sunday. And it might do, you know, it might just be something as simple as that. I was amazed how quickly Chelsea recovered from the first match against Brighton towards the end of December, and they looked absolutely running on fumes, and yet revitalised and performed very, very well against Liverpool a few days later, and had a lot more energy and dynamism about them then. So maybe a couple of days, 48 hours without football will have that effect again ahead of Spurs. But the bottom line is that they have played, I think it's 18 matches in 59 days, which in normal circumstances, yeah, it's a lot, but it's playing every midweek effectively since the towards the end of November. So it's a heavy workload, but it's not necessarily disastrous. But when you've got COVID around the scene as well and denying you players and forcing some to come back with knocks, etc., it does have a cumulative effect and will ensure that the fatigue is more of an issue. I think their previous 18 games have been spread over something like 87 days. So, you know, another 5 weeks effectively or 4 weeks, which is a lot more manageable. But you know, it is what it is. Brighton will turn around and say, "Well, we've got a much smaller squad, and we were without Yves Bissouma at the African Cup of Nations, and he was absolutely outstanding at Stamford Bridge. They were without Lewis Dunk, their captain and talisman, and Adam Lallana wasn't playing, and they even started Mopay and Trossard on the bench. So that, you know, even with their elements of their second 11, they outplayed Chelsea for long periods."
Before we move on from this game, Simon, is Thomas Tuchel under pressure yet?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and he's showing signs of it as well. In press conferences is a great example. Perhaps listeners aren't privy to every single exchange, because obviously some questions are asked off camera, but some of his responses are a bit more chippy, a little bit more sort of biting back at the questioner, you know, even though they're sort of perfectly innocent questions. He knows what the standards are at Chelsea. He knows Chelsea's history. He knows that when there's a downturn, when a champion's basically when top four is at risk, that a manager starts coming under scrutiny. Now, are we sort of approaching the end game? Of course not. He's got a lot of credit in the bank, but Chelsea's run of results is poor in the league. He was very quick to point out the other night. He went, "Oh yeah, but you know, we've won in cup competitions." But yeah, that's true. But no Chelsea manager in the Abramovich era is going to be getting away with or not coming under scrutiny for a run of 1-7, or I think it's 3-11. I mean, this is a really, really bad run. And on the plus side, and sort of touching on the sort of Dom's point, about sort of Chelsea's revival between Brighton and Liverpool, I almost sort of think that Tottenham is a great game for Chelsea to have. It's a game where they know they have to turn up in, particularly now after, you know, with the gap in the table and their position the top four under pressure, that this is a must-win game for them. They can't feel sorry for themselves. They've got to get up for this one.
I thought his mannerisms for the first time on the touchline, he looked knackered as well. He looked as if it was getting to him, and that I thought that was quite telling. His post-match interview was very, very deflated, and until actually he was it was put to him that he did look down, and then he suddenly reanimated and almost made the effort to show that he you know, he has still got the energy and the desire and the ambition, etc. But I thought during the game, for someone who's usually, he's not quite Antonio Conte manic, but he's up and down, and he's bellowing instructions, usually screaming at Callum Hudson-Odoi, and there wasn't very little of that actually. He spent a lot of time sitting down talking to Zsolt Lowe and the technical staff on the bench, and looked a bit deflated by it all as well.
Well, given the magnitude of the game and given Antonio Conte will be there too, expect the fourth official will be a busy man come Sunday. We'll look ahead to Chelsea versus Tottenham next.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Chelsea versus Tottenham again then, episode 3 of the January mini-series. Probably won't see any key characters killed off, but there might well be a big reveal in terms of who's likelier to finish in the top 4. Listen, this is why I leave the words to the chaps. Joining us now to talk Tottenham is Charlie Eccleshare, who covers Spurs for The Athletic. You'll know him too from his fine work on the Totally Football Show and Football Clichés podcast. Charlie, we're talking just hours after the amazing end to that game on Wednesday at Leicester. I get the impression that that kind of finish wouldn't have happened under Nuno or even under Jose.
No, probably not. Under Jose, more likely the other way round. They had this habit of conceding late goals. And under Nuno, the idea of there being 5 goals in a game is just so ridiculous that I can't really comprehend that. It's probably not something they want to keep having to do every week. I don't think it's that sustainable, but it was an amazing finish. And I mean, it's amazing how much it changes the mood and the complexion of Conte's start a little bit, because there was a lot of optimism. Then the Chelsea Carabao Cup semi-finals were so dispiriting, the way they were kind of just swatted aside, like it wasn't even a contest. I think had they then lost yesterday, I was surprised, because going into the, you know, after Chelsea, by the kind of ferocity against Conte almost and against the team for what I felt was just losing to a superior side. And I know it's, you know, obviously it's never nice to lose to one of your rivals, but I didn't think it was so catastrophic. So had they lost yesterday, it was, I think there would have been quite a lot of anger and frustration. Whereas now they've won the game, people are looking at the league table and suddenly thinking, hold on a minute, we're actually in a really strong position for the top 4. And it makes the Chelsea game a bit of a free hit for them.
Yeah, so it's 8 points behind with 4 games in hand. From what you've seen so far, do you think that they're likely to bridge the gap to Chelsea? Is that even a thought, or is it just about top 4? It doesn't matter who we catch for it.
I think it is more about top 4. Realistically, and that again looks really healthy given their gap to West Ham, which isn't much, and how many games in hand they've got. So I think given how much better Chelsea looked than Spurs over those 2 games in the Carabao Cup, I think most fans realistically wouldn't expect to finish above them. And even though, as you say, it's only 8 points, some of those games in hand aren't that straightforward. But the main thing is top 4, and that definitely does feel on, which, given where they were when Conte took over, I mean, they weren't actually that many points off it, but the whole mood of the place by the end of the Nuno interregnum, it's quite a turnaround.
Is Conte actually happy at Spurs, do you think? I mean, he's doing classic Conte stuff, but playing the hits a little earlier than they normally come out. Is that just because it's January and he'd like some new players?
Yeah, I also think it's Conte. I don't imagine he's ever really that happy. I mean, he seems like the kind of guy who even on his wedding day would be a bit like, yeah, but, you know, what about the honeymoon? And then, you know, what about this? And we've got to make sure this is right. You know, he's just an incredibly demanding, exhausting character to be around, but does seem to yield results. So happiness and Conte, I don't know. But I certainly think he... I think the Chelsea defeat, especially the first leg, hurt him really badly. I think he genuinely felt humiliated going back to a former employer and it not even being a contest. It was so one-sided and I think that angered him so much. And I think that's why that press conference straight afterwards and his Sky interviews were strikingly negative, you know, given it was so early in his reign and given it wasn't that bad a result. You know, it was a 2-0 defeat to Chelsea. But I think his mood definitely would have been helped by last night. But that said, I don't think he'll have seen that and been like, oh, great, yeah, now we don't need to make signings. I think he'll be like, no, we won, but we still absolutely need to make signings to, you know, take the next step.
Will the first leg of the Carabao Cup semi-final in particular inform the team that he picks on Sunday, do you think? That there won't be any kind of random Matt Doherty appearing somewhere where you wouldn't expect him to, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's got to just take the positives from Leicester and try and use that. And Doherty actually came on in the second half. And I mean, it's such a different game. I mean, he was basically this sort of agent of chaos, but playing in his actual position as a right wing back. And he did make a big difference, just kind of charging into the area and no one was really tracking him. And I do wonder, Chelsea are this, from an outsider's perspective anyway, and I know the results haven't been so good, but they're this well-oiled machine and everyone seems to know exactly what they're doing. I do just wonder if... having someone like that who is a bit chaotic might throw them a little more than trying to be regimented and defensive. So we might see something like that. But I don't think he's got the squad at the moment with injuries to throw too many curveballs. He doesn't have that many options available to him. So I think we'll see a very similar team to what we did on Wednesday night against Leicester. I don't think any of the injured players will be back. So, yeah, maybe that, but nothing too zany. I think he'll probably stick with a 3-5-2. The other thing is whether Bergwijn comes in the team after scoring those two late goals. That is quite a big decision, and that could influence whether he goes 3-4-3 or 3-5-2. But I think he'll want the three guys in midfield to try and stiffen that area up against Chelsea.
Charlie, can I ask about a couple of the players in particular? Bergwijn, you just mentioned. There were lots of talk that he was going to go to Ajax next week, and presumably that deal is now off. And another player, Harry Kane, has been so off colour all season and was in the two games against Chelsea in the Carabao as well. He had 10 shots against Leicester. Is that him back to his best, or is he just more profligate than ever?
Well, we'll start with Bergwijn. I mean, the sense already was that Ajax weren't going as high as what Tottenham wanted. And you feel that's only going to be a more difficult gap to bridge because Spurs can go a little bit higher now, given that his stock has risen quite substantially after those two late goals. And I mean, he was one who Spurs were willing to let go, but it would have been more reluctant. It wasn't a kind of Dele or Ndombele situation where they were really keen to get rid of them. It was more he's one of our few saleable assets. We'll sort of begrudgingly take it so we can do some business of our own. Yeah, now that looks a lot less likely. And it'll be interesting to see whether he kicks on. I mean, it does. We kind of assume he will, but it doesn't always happen like that. I mean, Lucas Moura, after that hat-trick in Ajax, it wasn't like he was then, you know, changed particularly as a player. He carried on more or less the same. And it's only more recently he's made some quite substantial improvements. Kane, I don't think last night was totally isolated. I know he was really poor in those Chelsea games, but there have been signs of improvement. He does look fitter and sharper. The Liverpool game just before Christmas, he was way, way better, scored, did miss a few. And I know this is a bit of a cliche, but for much of the season, he wasn't even getting chances. So I think at least in that Liverpool game, he was getting chances, which felt like a step forward. He then had a really good goal, perfectly good goal disallowed against Southampton. And then yesterday, yeah, I mean, it is encouraging because his calling card for a long time, he was averaging like 5 shots a game in 2017-18, which is just crazy. And actually, his numbers were up to about 4 in Premier League games under Conte even before last night. So, yeah, now that's going to be even higher than that. So I think he is like, he looks a lot better. He feels way fitter. And I think he's almost been surprised by how quickly that Conte effect has kicked in with him. But it is such a big step up. I mean, that's the thing with all of this is that, you know, in a way, Spurs and Kane have been insulated in his first league games, because Liverpool aside, and Liverpool were kind of COVID ravaged and looked a bit knackered, the quality of the opposition has been such that they've kind of looked okay. But then Chelsea was such a wake-up call, because they looked so second best and Kane looked so peripheral. So it will be really revealing on Sunday, both where Spurs are at and where Kane's at, because if he has another game like he did in those other Chelsea games, I guess you could say, well, he's not getting the service. But I think you're also then thinking, well, does he not need to be stepping up? And he shouldn't just be doing it against teams like Leicester. And I know that sounds harsh, but that's how high the standards are for Harry Kane. We expect so much from him.
Hi, Charlie. How much do you think the psychological impact plays on this game in terms of Tottenham's record at Stamford Bridge? And secondly, can you go on record to say which press room serves the best food, please?
This is the level of
conversation we get on this podcast, by the way.
Si and I did have this debate in the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium last week, and I would go to Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. I think the whole package, the fact that it's more leisurely, you're kind of sat down, whereas Chelsea, the food is of an exceptional quality, but I don't know, it's not as spacious, and it feels like you're being rushed through a little bit. Tottenham is it has that edge, and that
people
is the real
not
quiz,
interested
as we know.
In this. They're not interested in this.
They're fascinated.
This is what the fans want to know.
Yeah, this is the real behind-the-scenes stuff that The Athletic brings you, these key details. And then on the less important issue of the psychological block, yeah, I do think that's something. And I think that's also the flip side. It seems to galvanise Chelsea, because a lot of Spurs fans watched the way Brighton took the game to Chelsea, played really well, could have won that game, and looked like they weren't inhibited in the same way. So a lot of Spurs fans were saying, okay, well, last week you were telling us that we lost to Chelsea because they're the Champions League holders and they're just much better than us. Well, then why are Brighton able to go and perform as well as they did? And I do think Chelsea, they do seem to have a bit of a swagger when they play Spurs. Like, they're so used to beating them, especially at Stamford Bridge. And I think generally as well, you know, Spurs, they beat United at Old Trafford last season. But, you know, for most teams, it is rare to go and win these big games away. And I wonder as well what effect the fact they've lost these two games so recently. I don't know. Will that help them in some ways? Will that clarify for things? Will they have learnt from those games? Or does it just play into this slight inferiority complex that it always seems to go against them at Chelsea? But it will be interesting. And I don't know as well how much it's just a psychology thing and how much just a quality thing. Because certainly in that first leg, you looked at the two teams. And I remember in the second leg as well, I tweeted that, you know, the Chelsea bench, pretty much everyone on the bench would have had a case to get in that Spurs team that day. So I don't know how much it is psychology and how much it's just that the Chelsea players are of a higher quality.
We'll find out on Sunday, I guess. Charlie, thanks so much for your time. Enjoy your butter chicken on Sunday pre-match and hopefully don't enjoy the game too much. We'll speak to you soon.
Cheers. Speak soon, guys.
Simon, from a Chelsea perspective, it sounds like there's a little bit of good news injury-wise. Trevor Chalobah hopefully back in training before the game, whether he'll be available or not. Andreas Christensen maybe not too far away. And Reece James apparently back out on grass, as they say.
Yeah, I still think it's a little bit of a question mark whether they're back in time for Tottenham. But I just think sort of like the fact they're back in training already, and of course got this winter break coming up. It just gives Chelsea sort of more of a hope after in terms of when Chelsea get back up and running next month, because they're going to need everybody. There's definitely signs of fatigue, and the more Tuchel can rotate, the better.
Question for both of you. One word answer, please. Dom, you can go first. Who's likely to stay in their current job longer, Tuchel or Conte?
Tuchel.
Interesting. Simon?
Well, I'll say Conte then.
It's tough, isn't it?
It's just part of the game.
It's 4:30 UK time for Chelsea versus Tottenham Hotspur at Stamford Bridge, of course. We'll react to that in Monday's pod.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Elsewhere in Chelsea news, Thomas Tuchel and Emma Hayes were named the best coaches and Edouard Mendy the best goalkeeper at the FIFA Best Awards this week. Yeah, football's governing body seemingly desperate to be associated with the word best. Simon, Dom, anybody got anything to say about these awards? It's nice to win them, but I mean, they're just nonsense really, aren't they?
It's so last year. It's the thing is, it's just like, you know, whatever. Like Chelsea got to worry about the here and now, not sort of dwell on. And this is how Tuchel's been talking about all the awards and the big fuss about sort of Mendy not being included in the Ballon d'Or and et cetera, et cetera. He's always been pretty consistent in this regard, going he doesn't really like awards. It's all about the team, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a fun. Well, I'm not sure it's even fun. It's a debate on Twitter, isn't it? Whenever these awards are handed out, but really, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't mean very much, I don't think.
I liked Emma Hayes' reaction when she won, and likewise, the Senegalese team's reaction to Mendy winning was nice. And also the fact that Thomas Tuchel was still clad in his Chelsea tracksuit. I can't remember what time of the night it was that he was accepting the award, but clearly he sleeps in the thing.
Well, speaking of Emma Hayes, her team were finally back in action on Wednesday night. They won 4-2 against West Ham in the League Cup quarterfinals in what was their first action of 2022. As the Athletic's Abby Patterson pointed out on Twitter, the goal scorer is read like a Scottish version of Daft Punk. Harder, harder, Cuthbert, harder. Pernilla Harder, the star of the show, with a hat trick. Here's what Emma Hayes had to say about her.
I thought Pernilla had a fantastic game, and she set the tone from the start. I thought her and Fran, their relationship improved the longer the game went on. I thought she found a lot of the right spaces, especially the second half. I thought her quality in and out of possession, you know, was excellent.
Well, the women return to WSL duty on Sunday when they go to Brighton. They beat the Seagulls 3-1 in the corresponding fixture back in October. The men's under-23s were beaten by Crystal Palace, much to Dom's delight. That was earlier this week. They don't play again until Monday next week when they host Manchester City at King's Meadow. The under-18s, meanwhile, have a derby date with Arsenal on Saturday. All right, we know why we're all really here. It's our weekly quiz, and it comes next. Right, chaps, perfect scores last week from Messrs. Toomey and Parking, so huge pressure on you.
Excuse me, we'll have none of that, thank you very much. It was Parking and Fifield last week.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. I seem to be on three quizzes in a row on this, slightly alarmingly. Simon Johnson, I'm sure you've had time to do with the scheduling.
Lucy can investigate that, I'm sure. But anyway, that's one of the questions is not who did the quiz last week. As you can imagine, it's Chelsea v Spurs.
I could have got that one right.
I'd have got it wrong.
I can't make my mind up about this quiz. It's either really easy or really hard. So we'll find out in, I don't know, 5 minutes' time. Simon, you're up first. How many of his 40 games in charge of Chelsea did former Blues and Spurs boss Andre Villas-Boas win?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
How many of his 40 games in charge of Chelsea did former Blues and Spurs boss Andre Villas-Boas win?
Oh, crikey. Da. 40 games. Let me think. I'm going to go with 19.
Oh, it's such a shame. Don, would you like to steal it?
Oh, 20.
20's correct.
Oh! Well, you kind of gave it away with
yeah,
me.
I did. All right, I'll give you half a point for that, Dom, because I did kind of give it away a bit there. Here's your first question, Dom. Which former Spurs goalkeeper was on the bench for Chelsea in their 1-0 win at White Hart Lane in 2004?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Classic. Which former Spurs goalkeeper was on the bench for Chelsea in their 1-0 win at White Hart Lane in 2004?
Was it Neil Sullivan?
It was Neil Sullivan. Incredible. 1.5-0 going into the second question for Johnson, which is, who was the last Spurs player to score against Chelsea?
Oh, good question.
I'm trying to think of bloody... I'm trying to think of those scores. Have Tottenham ever scored? No.
Not for a while.
Son.
It's not Son, Dom. Can you steal it?
No. Lucas Moura?
No, it was Eric Lamella in the League Cup tie in September last season. Okay. So this takes us to your second question, Dom. How many Chelsea players were booked during the infamous battle at the Bridge game with Spurs that finished 2-2 in 2016?
Oh, dear. I wasn't even there. The majority were Tottenham players. Four?
No, Simon, do you want to steal it? For reference, there were 9 Spurs players booked.
Three.
3 is correct. There you go. You're back.
Well done, Si.
Yeah, I could have done the Spurs one as well, because I was there. It's 9-3, but Chelsea got the bigger fine from the FA for failing to control the players, because they'd been punished quite a few times, in fairness.
That's going to happen when you've got Diego Costa in your team. It's just inevitable. Okay. So Simon's on the board with a point. So by my maths, that makes it 1.5 to Dom and 1 to Simon, ahead of Simon's final question. Who scored the last of his 3 Chelsea goals in the 4-3 Blues win against Spurs at the Bridge in February 1994? If you get this, I'll give you the money myself.
Right, wait a minute. He scored 3 goals for Chelsea.
Scored 3 goals for Chelsea, the final of which came in a 4-3 Chelsea win against Tottenham at Stamford Bridge in February 1994.
Mal Donaghy.
That is absolutely correct. I'm sorry to inform you there's no money available, but the kudos is immeasurable. How on earth do you know that?
It was a very memorable game, that one. And partly because Mal Donaghy scored.
Donaghy. Peacock. Was played as a free spirit behind the front two. That's a lovely ball for Donaghy. Can he make something for himself? And it's in. Off the inside of the post. And Chelsea, from a most unlikely route, see a way back into the game.
But it was a bit of a relegation battle as well. Both teams were down near the bottom of the table. It was Hoddle v Ardiles, if memory serves me right.
Well, this isn't a relegation battle, but Dom, you've got to get this right. Otherwise,
this is a scandal.
You'll be heading for defeat.
Absolute scandal.
All right, this is the easiest question of the quiz, so I think you'll get it. In 2014, who celebrated opening the scoring in a 4-0 win against Spurs by grabbing the corner flag and holding the small of his back, seemingly symbolising that he was, as his manager had implied in a leaked recording earlier that week, old?
Samuel Eto'o.
That was a tap in, that.
Well, yeah, still, I think you get the win, Dom, just about. That was very funny, wasn't it? I really enjoyed that Samuel Eto'o season at Chelsea. He was he only ever scored at Stamford Bridge, but got a hat-trick against Man United. Am I making that up?
He did. Yeah, I sort of always say that because he picked up an injury sort of around March time. And I think that that had a big impact on Chelsea's ability to win the league, because he was actually in really good form. It may have been after the 6-0 win over Arsenal, for example. I just vaguely remember him getting injured for a crucial 6-week period. Quality player, even at that age. And then he went to Everton and then started to look his age.
Somebody who doesn't look their age, or maybe, no, I'm not even going to say that because that is not a good link. Before we go, let's get some plugs for what the chaps have been writing about. Simon, Armando Brogier / Armando Broya is somebody you've been speaking a fair bit about on the podcast. You've taken a look at what happens next for him in terms of his Chelsea career.
Yeah, because it is a major talking point with Southampton wanting to sign him permanently, and it's a very sensitive subject among Chelsea fans, and for good reason, having sort of sold a lot of the family silver last summer. Can they really sort of afford to let another youngster go? But it's a complex situation. Is it the best thing for Broha? Is it the best thing for Chelsea in terms of he's going to play more at Southampton realistically? You know, Chelsea have dug themselves a hole. They've basically got a bunch of strikers, bunch of attacking talent they've paid an absolute fortune for that aren't performing. It's very difficult for a manager in that situation to drop them and put a 20-year-old, in relative terms, rookie in instead. For him, it's very difficult for him to handle that situation, even though I totally get from fans' point of view, they'll say, oh, yeah, you know, just make the change. That's what you're in the job to do. You can imagine there'd be a few sort of discussions going on between board and Tuchel if things like that happen. So it's a really, really awkward decision. What's best for Broya? What's the best for his career? What's the best for Chelsea? So, yeah, I'm just sort of making out that it's not as clear cut as perhaps sort of fans and readers think. Also, you know, you have to look at it realistically and say, in terms of sellable assets, that the youngsters are the ones that are the most easy to do deals for, because Chelsea, as I said, have spent a fortune on players who are on very high wages and will be very hard to get rid of. And we've seen that now for a few years now.
I guess, Tom, it'd be unlikely that they'd have both Brogier and Conor Gallagher back around the first team next season. Is it a one or the other kind of situation?
Well, I'd like to think not. I mean, playing very different positions. And I think, I mean, you'd like to think that clubs generally would learn from this season and the way it's gone, in the likelihood that, okay, we may not be quite as, some of the rules may have changed for next year's inevitable spike in the latest, metamorphosis of COVID-19. But there will be presumably the risk of games being postponed and a backlog of fixtures and key players being ruled out. And you know, it's a very, very difficult situation, as Si has painted there in Broha's situation. But with hindsight, some of the decisions made in the summer, they will be regretting. They must be. Livramento going to, I know, last year of his contract, difficult situation, may not be getting enough game time. Well, actually, if he had stayed around, he probably would have got enough game time to persuade him that actually, A, he could show his quality in this Chelsea team, and B, that he deserved, it makes sense him prolonging his stay at the club. I know with Reece James on the scene, it wasn't going to be easy, but the reality is, the sheer number of games that Chelsea have got, they knew they were going to play potentially 60 matches this season, really. And they've just been left exposed and having to play Azpilicueta at right wing back or a winger at wing back. And I just think they will have looked at that, and that there will be somebody somewhere will be regretting that decision to let him go to Southampton. Likewise, possibly Gallagher. Okay, these players may have wanted to go last summer, but then it's a case of the club having to persuade them that actually, no, you should stick about. You will get your chances. It will happen this season because of COVID, because of the number of games we're going to play. And I'm being simplistic. That's a very simplistic way of looking at it. And it's not, it wouldn't be an easy conversation to have with those guys. But I think it would have, had they stayed, Chelsea would have been in a better position, arguably, possibly, you know, over the last month or so. I mean, obviously, there's always a possibility that those guys would have been ruled out with COVID as well at the wrong times. But having more bodies in the building would have helped Chelsea get through this period. And I just hope they don't make the same mistakes again. And that's coming from somebody that's actually benefited from that, because Mark Gay's been brilliant at Palace, and Conor Gallagher has obviously become a talisman for that team, and I've very much enjoyed his development. But from Chelsea's point of view, it doesn't make a lot of sense, really.
Do you think, Simon, that Chelsea will be more reluctant to loan players out next season then, given what's happened this season and what Dom's just spoken about?
I mean, I suppose a lot of that depends on sort of where COVID is going a little bit. You know, sort of, it's hard to have a crystal ball. This is sort of where you have some sympathy for them in some ways, because it's very hard to forecast. You know, Ben Chilwell being out for the season, Reece James picking up a long-term injury. It can also be a negative to have too many bodies around the place and not kicking a ball. That's why I'm sort of written a piece saying it's so difficult. I'm sure Tuchel will be aware of what's happened, but also that, you know, there are players that, not even youth players, that are just sitting around barely doing anything, whether that's because that's Tuchel's choice or whatever. But, you know, you've got Ross Barkley still there, sort of. He's barely kicked the ball the last few months. So if you add like a whole bunch of youth players to that, as talented as they are, it can actually cause you a headache. That's why it's such a fine balance between strength of squad and having too many players just sort of sitting about the place. Personally, I don't want Brozier to go. I've pronounced it both ways now in the same podcast. I think he's a fantastic talent, and he's actually exactly what Chelsea need. I think he'd be superb for Chelsea in terms of and sort of relieving some of the pressure of that rotation. But the problem is if you play Brozier, what's going on with Havertz and Werner and Lukaku? You know, it's just... It's a bit of an awkward situation at Chelsea at the moment.
For the avoidance of doubt, this is how you say Armando Broja / Brozier, according to a natural Albanian.
Broja.
What else is on the agenda, Simon?
Well, I've interviewed Jesse Marsh, the former RB Leipzig, RB Salzburg, New York Red Bulls coach, obviously also worked with the US national team, talking about a number of subjects. Of course, also, you know, obviously what happened at RB Leipzig, what went wrong. But I particularly enjoyed our chat, which took place in a swanky London hotel. I was very much out of place. About Erling Haaland, of course, a certain player that he worked with very much early in his career. He just joined from Molde, and he talks glowingly about his character. Because from the outside, people talk about his personality, whether he's got an ego, whether he's difficult to manage. But Jesse sort of talks about who Erling Haaland really is and why he is heading to the top. Well, he's already at the top, but you know what I mean, to be one of the all-time greats. I also liked, in particular, his memories of a certain England 1, USA 1 in the World Cup of 2010, where he talked about the bus being held up by some elephants on the way to the game. So if these managers to this day think they've got problems, at least they haven't had to deal with some elephants blocking their pathway to a game of football.
Athletic.com/ChelseaPod, the place to go to sign up if you aren't currently a subscriber. Many thanks to Dom and to Simon for their company today, and to Lucy for knocking it all together, and to Charlie for joining us earlier as well. We'll be back on Monday to react to that Spurs game. Do join us then if you can. Until then, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.